quick question for you. Is capitalism good or bad?
I'm gonna go 7.
Oh, dude. Right. No.
Bro, your lighting actually looks so good.
It's on a white strips box.
Watch out for.
I agree. Is the biggest threat.
What sells is you.
Private property is inherently theft.
I just don't agree with that. So in one sense, I'm like, I don't want war. But if I have to choose between getting like fleeced by
we gotta do it.
There's honey in the Cubans here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dude, come on. We're already cooking on that.
I'm just thinking about other sandwiches.
3, 2, 1. We're live. Hey, guys.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
What's up?
Whoa. There is a third voice on the call. And if you guys don't recognize him by his voice, his name is Luca Guglielmi.
Yeah, Guglielmi.
I said in the last episode, but yeah. So we mentioned Luca before. He's the top fan of our podcast.
Usually number one fan, every baby.
Video. Yeah. Seriously, number one fan. He's a good friend of ours. I met him at Unity First. Marillo on our first day grabbed me and was like, Nate, come here. I need you to roll with this guy. On the first day, and whenever our head coach says that, I know like it's time to turn it up. We've been good buddies ever since. Luca was there at my bachelor party, and now that I left New York, Miguel and Luca are best of buds also. But we have Luca on the pod today to talk about what he's been working on, and he's leaving New York soon, so we kind of just wanted to like catch up real quick before he leaves.
Yeah, yeah. When I first met Luca was for Nate's birthday. We had a birthday dinner in Chinatown, and I sat next to Luca, and I wasn't a jiu-jitsu guy, so everyone was talking about jiu-jitsu. And then, I don't know, I think you asked me a question, and I was like, oh, I just can't wait to go home and play Elden Ring. And then we went down the rabbit hole. We went down the rabbit hole talk about Elden Ring. And then one thing led to another, and I actually saw Luca last weekend for his going away party. So both of y'all trained jiu-jitsu in New York and decided, cool, I'm going to peace out and go somewhere else. So I think it's fun, though, that we get to stay in touch doing other stuff. We'll talk about that on the side, not just the podcast, but also Galactic Conquering. But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. I really do appreciate it. I definitely am the number one fan of the podcast. I've fallen behind a little bit. I think I might have missed your last episode because I've just been so busy packing. I don't think I might have watched the start of it, but I didn't get the full thing, so it's good to be on.
I know you didn't watch it because we gave you a really big shout out at the end, and
I didn't respond.
Oh, and no. You didn't. And I knew, thinking in my head, as soon as Luca watched this, he's gonna text me. It was such a big shout out.
No, and I didn't. Dude, I've been so swamped with like packing. The last 2 weeks have just been like a shit show. And I actually think one thing I kind of was curious about for you, Nate, you were starting to get into the social media kind of like stuff that you're getting into before you started moving. How hard was it to maintain the like side thing while you were moving? Because for me, like I've got this side hustle that we're gonna get into, and it's been really hard between like my full-time job and packing and like still being a good like boyfriend and like taking care of our dog and keeping our house in order. It's really been affecting like the amount of time I can put into that over the last 2 weeks, which has sucked, honestly. But I was curious if you had like a similar experience.
Yeah, it definitely was really hard. I had the added challenge too. I messaged, do you know Matt Arroyo? He's like a jiu-jitsu practitioner. He owns a gym. He fought against Gordon Ryan one time.
Practitioner and not just jiu-jitsu guy. Like
maybe jiu-jitsu ka. I think in Japanese they say jiu-jitsu ka, like judoka.
Really?
I don't know. He's a Dave Bautista jiu-jitsu coach. Anyways, I messaged him about like how to grow because he's got like 500,000 on Instagram. And he basically said, post every day for like a month and see how it goes. So I actually challenged myself like for 2 months to post every day for like 60 days straight. So like,
it's so hard.
While I was planning the move, and it was really hard and it was really stressful, but like honestly it was because of my wife Ariel. She did a lot of like the logistical work. I was more of like just like the hands-on help, and honestly my emotional state took a big turn. Like I definitely was picking fights with Ariel a lot because I was just so stressed all the time.
Yeah, the stress sometimes is like over like what to do in the present moment. Like what do I need to do like right now? Because there's like four different things I can be doing. And so like some of my, I really like having like setting my life up in a way where I am like know exactly like what leads into the next. Like, I go to work, I go to jiu-jitsu, I go home, I shower, and then I start, like, working, like, coding again, or I go to work, I shower, I go to, like, go to jiu-jitsu, go home, go on a date. Like, I need to be, have my life laid out in, like, that way, because if I have, like, four different if I just, like, have, like, nothing to do, a la the movie Office Space, like, that crushes me completely, because I'm just, like, there's too many options of what to do. I hate it. I don't like that.
Interesting thing that I was thinking about earlier this week is a lot of times when we kind of like make the decision to pursue a side hustle or a hobby or like to dive deeper into something, like you decide to like compete in jiu-jitsu or Muay Thai or something like that. Usually when you make that decision, it's because not all the things that you're juggling are overwhelming at the same time. But then the moments like this come up where it's like, shit, now, like, it's probably just so happens that work is also coming down on you at the same time, and you're moving, like, and all of a sudden all these things are happening, and you started rolling that one ball uphill, and now you're like, okay, I can't get to you right now because I have to, like, manage this, and there's the thing that you want to do, and then there's the thing that you should do, and sometimes you're just like, I should do something, but I don't want to do it, so I just won't do it at all. And then you end up having like that internal conflict. So it's normal. I think it's super normal. I was thinking about that this week, and so
I feel like that's something like New York. I don't know if it like what the best way to put it. Like it taught me, but then also I just feel like New York really encourages. Like everyone in New York has like five different side hustles they're managing, and I just feel like living in New York with that like energy, like it's addicting, but it's also a lot of pressure. You know, you got to have your hobby, you got to have your side hustle, you got to have your regular job, you got to have your active social life, your romantic life. And I just feel like, I don't know, it was getting too much for me after like 7 years, so I had to leave. And it's just now that I'm gone, I feel like I have space to breathe, and I don't know if I could go back in there. I mean, I know I can, but I don't know if I want to.
That's so interesting. I don't know.
Yeah,
that you see New York in that way, because I see it's like I totally see where how you could see New York, and I feel like this comes down to like social circles, right? Like if you have like a bunch of people who are like that around you, I can totally see that vibe. I just feel like the people that I know in New York just go out a lot. Like I feel like there's a lot of people in New York that they're like their other thing outside of work is just like going out, like
drinking
going
to bar, oblivion,
like drinking. Like, it's honestly, like, shocking the number of people I know in New York who's, like, it's work and drinking. And that's it. It's, like, I don't know. It's trippy to me.
How many of those are in
– it's all the finance. It's the finance guys.
Yeah, it could be industry specific. But the thing is with those guys,
they're doing 80 to 100-hour weeks, so they don't really have time to, like
–
you know, three of those five boxes I just mentioned are – dude, my first two roommates, my first two roommates in New York, one was only in finance. The other one was an actual investment banker. The finance guy was 70 to 80. The investment banker was 100 to 120. Literally never home.
It depends on what you're doing. What I think is so funny about what they call like a 100-hour week, they include the time that they get in at like 9 a.m. and the time they spend till 2 doing nothing at their desk because their MD has not assigned them anywhere.
Oh, that's one. I remember one time my friend told me he got home at 6 a.m. or my roommate told me he got home at 6 a.m., had to wake up at 8. And I asked him, why were you like at the office so long? Why didn't you just go home? He said, because I had to wait for my manager to take a look at my deck.
And yeah, no, like, they just wait. Dude, it's crazy inefficient. It's crazy inefficient. Honestly.
Super
easily. I mean,
like, Luca, you know, like, as an engineer, like, most of our job is like actually on deliverables and what we actually can code. I have like maybe if I have 2 hours, maybe a second 2 hour burst, but mainly 2 hours of like concentrated, dedicated hard work in my brain. I can't do more than that, honestly. Like if I'm really thinking hard, I can't do more than that.
I think what happens, I mean, if you really want to get into engineering, because I've been thinking about this so much, like most of my like time and thought recently has been going into like engineering and product and like how you do that shit well. And I think a lot of the reasons that you feel that way is poor management. I really do believe. I think that most companies, I read this book Inspired by Marty Kagan, which is like, if you talk to product people, and I'm not a product guy, I still have so much to learn in that regard. But it was like a book that a lot of really smart product people I know like referred to as like a Bible. And reading that was really interesting because it like breaks down it kind of like shattered my current like current perception of work of like the structures of engineering in a lot of ways, because I think like just a lot, the whole like sprint cycle, right? Like the typical life cycle. We're getting like very deep into just like,
yeah, guys, sprint cycle here. For people who don't work in like a tech, yeah, sprint cycle is just like a 2-week chunk of time where in engineering we decide we're going to get a certain amount of work done.
Yeah.
Typically, well, 1 to 2 weeks.
Yeah. I think that the sprint cycle is like necessary. Obviously, I'm not saying you should like not do sprints. I think like the typical 2-week sprint cycle with like Fibonacci numbered like tasks is really a crazy way to like approach like tracking and managing engineering resources. I think a better way to do it is to like, I think engineering departments have become too obsessed with like output, right? Like the number of tickets you complete, how much code you're writing, rather than looking at the like outcomes of what you're actually like trying to accomplish. And then what ends up happening is like as companies grow, like, and I've like seen this in my own experience, like as a company grows from like a Series B of like 40 people to like a Series D of like 200 plus people, the amount of like middle management that gets involved in like a sprint cycle is kind of crazy.
Is that?
Yeah, I hear you on that.
Would you say that that's something that encouraged you to, you know, pursue that quote unquote side hustle that you mentioned, where you like, I would like to have more control over how I'm spending my time, and instead of being like, oh, this is so frustrating, and seeing how something's working in a larger organization, having the ability to have like stay flexible and do things on your own accord?
In certain respects, yes. In other respects, no. Honestly, a big part of like what changed my mind is the company I work for bought another company at the end of last year, and the guys who founded that other company are fucking geniuses. Like the smartest two guys I think I've ever met in like a business sense. One guy's named Aaron LaRue. His co-founder is Judd Schoenholtz. They started a company called Balance Homes, which is like a co-ownership model essentially. So it's for people who are like pretty distressed in their like housing situation, and the business essentially buys into the mortgage with them, gives them equity to help pay off their debts and like get them back on course with their mortgage. It's like a really good product. Both sides like stand to make money because you get, the buyer gets involved in the appreciation of the house and gets the equity at a discount, right? In the hope that they can get them out of debt and sell that equity for like full value when the person's not distressed. So it's like a really good
idea.
This is your current
day-to-day job?
This is my current day-to-day job. The company that I work for bought them. The product that my company sells is a little different. It's a sale leaseback. It's really not that interesting. What's more interesting is the two guys that ran this company have like a really different approach to product, and they kind of brought that with them when they came over. So like every task is always centered around like what they call a job to be done, which is kind of, it's not like necessarily a new idea, like writing the tickets as like user stories, but like a hyper diligence to that, to like always never let it become like kind of engineering e speak and like very
micro,
much
like micro sub steps. It's instead you're talking about more, like what's the concept that you're trying
it's
to
really focus on delivering like real tangible value. They also got rid of like a lot of the meetings that I had gone through, like so many long grooming sessions, so many long sprint planning sessions that I felt like were really inefficient. They actually don't assign tickets before a sprint starts. You just are expected to like grab shit. Like you grab shit if you, and in order to facilitate that, right, the refinement is really geared towards writing tickets in a way that anyone on the team can pick them up. So it's like coming about not just like consensus on like what needs to be technically accomplished, but also like discussing how it's going to be accomplished. Like, is this going to be a new endpoint in our API? Are we going to set this up as like a Lambda function behind a gateway? Like, it's really around stuff like that. And what it leads to is, in order to be successful as like an engineer in that culture, you have to be willing to like step up, because you're expected to like grab your own work. You're expected to like really be communicative in channels. Where I found a lot of times before, if you do like this typical sprint planning where you assign all the tickets at the start, right, everybody just kind of goes their separate ways. Like, you know what I'm talking about, Nate, or was it kind of different at Bloomberg?
No. I'm just talk briefly. Like, I agree that like That's been my experience. I feel like I've had kind of the issue where I'm usually the smartest engineer on my team, or sometimes even in
that's
the board.
That's a terrible position to be in, by the way.
Yeah, because like, especially because I'm not a manager, so they just assign me very black box objectives, like make the website faster. I remember my last company, I had a 2-month project of making the website faster, and it's like, okay, now I have to just like spend 2 months figuring out how I can fucking do that. Like, that's so complicated, and I don't have any like small term goals. But it sounds to me like there's a big paradigm shift for you guys. And I don't know if you're familiar with the ecological approach, dude, but it kind of sounds similar to that. Where like, you know, in jiu-jitsu, like we were kind of taught like jiu-jitsu is about following steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then eventually you're going to achieve some goal. But now the ecological approach has been this huge paradigm shift where people are instead stressing in whatever way you can get that guy's back on the mat. And that's like kind of the main thing. And instead of following steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is that kind of what you guys are going through right now?
Yeah. Wait, I actually have a question about that. This is kind of like a pivot in a way, but like, I was kind of following the ecological movement when it like first got added to jiu-jitsu. I haven't been like keeping up with it. Has it leveled off, or is it still like really becoming more and more popular? Are more and more gyms adopting it? Because it kind of feels like it leveled off a little bit.
I would say
layman speak for anyone listening.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So ecological approach. In English, it just means, what's the word? Like, emergent behavior. So, ecological approach isn't a jiu-jitsu-specific term. It just applies to, like, how systems, like, ecology, how humans and behavior develops out of specific systems. And, like, kind of not forcing things, but how they just emerge naturally. And so, it's kind of like this wave in jiu-jitsu where instead of, like, prescriptively telling people to put your hand here, make this grip, and then you will achieve this outcome, it instead tells people to just try to figure out a way on your own to achieve certain outcomes using concepts as your guiding principle. And to answer Luca's question.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, finish.
Yeah. Sorry. To answer your question, I would say, yeah, the fire around it has died, but I would say it's still growing a lot. Like, I think there's like something like 100 to 200 gyms who have adopted it. Wow. And like, in my experience, because I don't drill anymore, like I haven't drilled in about a year and a half.
Damn.
I'm finding it to be very effective. Like, and I can't imagine going to a gym where I would drill.
Wow. Is your current gym is fully ecological?
The classes I teach and like I also coach the private session. So it's like the kind of the coaches session, and the coaches that attend my class, they also teach, but there are some coaches in my school who aren't like so gung-ho about it, and they still drill. But I mean, it's whatever, you know. I'm not like a fervent evangelizer. I just believe it works for me, and so like I just choose to teach and learn that way.
When I think about like when we used to train on those Friday mornings, like that was probably as sharp as I ever was at jiu-jitsu.
Right.
Like when we were training like a lot, and a lot of our training was like the training sessions where I was making the most technical progress were those like openly formatted sessions where we were kind of like almost at like a before even ecological had been like discussed. We were kind of fucking around with like ecological like adjacent stuff. We'd be like, okay, like let's start in the middle of the movement, like let's try and get as close to like the part that matters, like is the most important.
I think
does
the biggest...
Greg ever talk about heuristics?
Yeah, I mean that's the whole design. So it's like the difference between positional sparring and a game, which is what he calls, is like instead of letting them just do whatever, he'll say, okay, at the start of this your goal is to grab their leg, and the heuristic for grabbing the leg is getting their arms out of the way. So, and that's kind of like how he teaches. I mean, we're kind of going really far off, but like my question to you is more like this paradigm shift, is it similar to what's happening at your company? Kind of like how have you taken this like new way of working into your own project?
Oh yeah. So
wait, and let's be clear. When we say your company, we're not talking about the company you work for.
No.
So because I think we're assuming a lot of things for anyone that's listening, that you know everything about what's going on with Luca. So just to clarify, Luca, can you
draw a line? The company. So me and my friend Shane Kreinberg from college had started talking about wanting to make a like software company around the time I got my knee surgery like last year. And our first thought was, let's do something related to the work we've done. So we've worked at institutional buyers, and by institutional buyers, that's big time companies that buy homes on scale, hundreds if not thousands of homes, and then do a lot of different things with them. Some companies hold them, some companies sell them immediately companies like mine hold them for a couple years, and then when the person decides they want to move out, dispose of them. Our first idea was, let's try and provide large-scale property management services for those companies. Like, companies like ours, a lot of times struggle to get good repairmen, and so they have to go to these like kind of localized and regionalized companies and pay a lot of money. And those companies take a huge chunk of that money and only give a small portion to the repairman that they contract. And the repairmen hate this experience, and the companies hate this experience. So we were like, oh, let's do something where we become the technical solution in the middle. Problem is, we don't understand repairmen at fucking all, and we couldn't figure out what they needed. We could understand what the institutional buyer needed, but that is like not it. Also, with marketplace businesses, like, they're really hard, and we weren't sure that we could start like a fast-paced marketplace business where we really would need like periodically connection, and that's like a really hard thing to make. So we kind of fizzled out with that idea, and then we got to a certain point where we were like, let's do something more in New York, let's do something that we like understand a little better, and we said, fuck it, let's just make a rentals listing service. We understand rentals, like we hate looking with the way looking for apartments work right now. Let's do that. And that's not really a business idea right there. Like, that's not an actual like solution. That's not solving a problem. That kind of like violates all the rules of starting a company, which is like solve a particular problem. We didn't do that when we started. But as we kind of like went down this rabbit hole of building a listing service, we started to think about all the things that you could pull into a listing service. And the first one of those was the rental application, right? And rental applications suck. They're really unfair. One, like the credit pull oftentimes is a lot less expensive than they're charging when they're charging $20, $30, $40, even $50. And New York is honestly actually good in that regard. The rest of the country pays way more for applications. And they're really hard to do. You essentially like Venmo a guy a lot of times. You put all your documents in an email and you email off. It's not secure. And you have to do that for every apartment you apply to, even though you are putting up the same information, right? So we said, let's make a consumer product around applications. So on our website, we're building a what we call a rental passport, where you are going to upload all your information once, you're going to pay a small fee, and you're going to be able to apply to every apartment on the site. And what this allows us to do, by making our money that way as a listing service, we can turn around to the agents who are currently getting completely fucked over by Street Easy, charging them $7 per listing per day. And we can say, this is a free service, right? And this really benefits, again, the user. So it helps the agent by making all their listings free. They can save hundreds, if not thousands, if not for the really big ones, tens of thousands of dollars a year. And at the same time, it's also going to be better for users, because if it's free for agents, now, right now, some listings are not on StreetEasy because the agent thinks that they can find a way to fill it and not pay that price. So that leads to an incomplete marketplace. And we think by offering the service for free, we're going to benefit the user, because now they are going to see every apartment long term in New York City. And that's right. Not something that exists right now. So
because well, they have to like jump into like Craigslist and be like, there might be some like fucking Cinderella, like Goldilocks type situations where I got lucky and I found something on Craigslist, because those are those guys that are like trying to go directly. But now you're also in those cases, you're like having to sift through the garbage and the spam. And yeah. So you're kind of, I get what you're saying, where like now you have like a more complete visibility to the options out there rather than just like having to jump around.
StreetEasy is also exclusive listings. So like that's an interesting thing to also break down.
So if it's on StreetEasy, it's not on Zillow.
So no. It can be on Zillow. What an exclusive means is it's represented by an individual agent, right? Open listings are when the landlord posts the listing publicly and says, anyone who brings me a tenant can get a cut, or if it's a fee apartment, the customer is going to pay for it. Oftentimes, those are the ones those are never on StreetEasy. Open listings are not; they don't allow it. It can be a little more of a wild west, right? They are oftentimes charging application fees that are over like the legal limit, because the legal limit's 20. But as we all know, how many times have you been asked for like $40? Like, it's super common. They don't abide by that law in any way, shape, or form, in my experience. So yeah, that's like the first kind of iteration of what we're thinking about. We think, though, this offers, like, long-term a lot of other options, right? Because we want to keep it free for both the user and the agent forever. And we also want to, like, make a lot of money. And so the way we want to do that is by selling other financial products as well. Because there's other things that you need as a tenant that right now you have to go outside of the listing service for. So, like, things like renter's insurance, which you're really required to have in most apartments, even though they don't check. And also, with more and more people becoming renters, guarantor as a service is going to become like a much bigger thing. And so what that is, like, say you know you make enough money for this apartment that you really, really want, but you don't have that like 60, 40, sometimes 60. I've even gotten 80x for like the amount of money you have to make as compared to monthly rent. And you really want that place and you can afford it, right? You don't have a guarantor. So we will actually, for a one-time fee, be your guarantor. That's something we want to build out long-term. This is something that currently exists. Say Rhino is the website that does it now. But the problem that they're going to have, right, is that they are going to have to advertise so heavily to get visibility. If you are part of the listing service itself, if you're selling it as part of the application process, it's going to be a lot easier to like attract people. And that's kind of like what we're going for.
Well, it's kind of like when you file your taxes on fucking TurboTax and there's just that like quick little like, hey, do you want to add this? And you're like, yeah, you know what? I actually do need that click.
And, yeah, exactly.
yeah, that's a lot more likely than.
Yeah. And even longer term, I think that application fees are deeply, deeply inefficient. I don't think that they actually make sense. There's a small amount of cost that is like inherent in a credit pull, right? Like you're gonna have to spend some amount of money, but there's no reason that that fee should ever be a reason you don't apply to an apartment. If there's other ways that a business can make money. And I think that there's just like a huge opportunity in rentals right now. I think the home buying space is like really kind of getting figured out. Like Zillow has found a way to like monetize. Okay. Quick pause. I actually think this is really interesting. I think this is so cool. Do you guys know about the Zillow / Expedia model?
No.
Okay. Tell us. This is super cool. So Zillow makes money in a really interesting way. You'd think Zillow like makes money from like advertising or selling products or people posting on there, but it's actually not that. What Zillow sells is you. Zillow sells your going to their website to agents. And you're like, really? Like that doesn't seem to be that lucrative. They make $500 million every 3 months doing this. Because agents will pay for home sales, the commission is really valuable. It's 3% for the buyer's agent and the seller's agent. If you can get one more person involved in a bidding war, right, you can drive up the home $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. That's like tangible amount of cash. And you'll pay hundreds to make a couple extra thousand, right? And that's a great, like super great business model for them. The problem that I think that they have is that it doesn't work for rentals. It doesn't work for rentals because the number of people interested in apartments is almost always in metro areas greater than the number of apartments available. That's why you have super high apartment prices in every major city. It's a lack of inventory, right? So who the hell is going to advertise for an apartment when you're going to have three people beating down your door? So why do they even do rentals? I actually like, I happen to know a guy who worked at Zillow for 5 years. And so I asked him, I was like, if they don't care about rentals, if they like don't think it's like a big part of the business, like why even do it? And for them, it's purely SEO. Like they just want to be the only thing in real estate. And they want to be the only thing in real estate because it helps them for the page rank, but it also helps if you found your apartment on StreetEasy or Zillow, if you live in the rest of the country, you're much more likely to go look for a home there. So like just that off chance, guys, that you'll come back to buy a home.
So for audio listeners only, on visuals, I'll put something up that shows what SEO is. But Luca just mentioned SEO. That's search engine optimization. He's basically saying Zillow wants to be, when you type into Google, renting
the
for
first
a home,
thing
buying a home.
For anything.
Zillow is trying to optimize for that. Like if you were to search on, you know, Corn Hub, or if you were to search for corn, Corn Hub is the first one that pops up for the first like three pages on Google.
Yeah. But yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And they don't care if it's like not, I mean, they still make on their rentals business advertising because the rest of the country doesn't have the same kind of like demand irregularity. They still make like a cool $90 million a quarter on this, jeez, which is crazy. But as the way that like the country is set up is changing and fewer people are going to be homeowners, more people are going to be renters, mm-hmm, longer, I think there's a real possibility that that forces a shift in their business and creates like a ton of opportunity in the rental space to like create solutions that facilitate rentals. Because historically, rentals have been ignored. Like either companies like just don't develop stuff for them, or the other thing that I think is really fucking stupid that the historically rental companies have done is they've tried to screw over the rental agent. I get why they've done this. It's because they don't see the value in an apartment that already exists, is owned by someone else. What the hell are you even doing here? Like, at least with a home sale, the agent that's there is the buyer's agent. This agent is representing the landlord. Why can't I just go to the landlord about this? And by trying to screw over the agent and by trying to, like, scrape listings online, which is something we don't really do and we're not really planning on doing, we want to have a relationship with the agents. Shit, where was I? Oh yeah, so we
were talking about screwing over the
agents. So historically, companies that like, my opinion is that historically companies that have tried to develop like rental software solutions have been overly consumer focused, and that's not a bad thing. Like it should, your goal should be to help the consumer, but if your goal is to completely erase an industry, that's a hard sell if you're too early. And I think that we still have about 2 to 3 decades of agents, particularly at least in the rental space. I think the home buyer space has a much longer timeline for like agents being involved for a lot of reasons, but in the rental space I think we have like at least 2 to 3 more decades of agents like being super super involved in the process. So why not try and facilitate like a good relationship there? So we haven't been scraping at all, which we could do. It's like not hard to get rental listings online by scraping like listing services that allow you to do this or don't put disclaimers. But that's like not something we want to do because we want the agent to like really come to us. So actually right now, like we're offering agents cash to come post their listings with us because we think that like this relationship can be like super mutually beneficial. Because like
where
we don't
are you
want
getting,
them
the money. Because I know, Luca, you mentioned this is like a startup for you guys. And for listeners who don't know Luca, he actually just started this project recently. He's been talking about it for a while. But where are you guys funding?
When did you fuck up your knee? When did you get knee surgery?
So I had knee surgery in last April, but I wouldn't say we really seriously started developing this till December 1st. The reason I know it was then is because me and my friend had like a very serious call about like, we're not making enough progress on this. We're moving too slowly. Like we need to, and he kind of called me out in a good way. Like he was like, dude, you're not doing enough for the project. Like you need to be more committed to this or like we should just like not do it. And it was like a very much like a come to Jesus moment. It's like we're either going to do this now or we're like not going to do it at all. And I was like, fuck, we got to do this now. And since then, since December 1st, we've been going ham. Like I'm so, so fucking excited about the things we've built. I think my favorite thing that we've built is like a showings, a really, really well integrated showings application into the listing service. So if you go to Street Easy, you know, if you want to request a showing, it just shoots off a fucking email. That is so dumb. Why do that? Why not actually allow the people to like track and manage all of their showings, like all the places that they're going to go, and like give them a good communication option directly where they're looking at the place? They shouldn't have to flip between Street Easy and email and a notes app where they're listing all the showings that they're going to do. Because I remember that's what me and Madison did. We just had like a shared Notion doc where we were posting the showings that we wanted to go see and like what time we'd requested them for. So we've been doing this for about 6 months. As for where we're getting the money right now, we're not paying like crazy amount because at the end of the day, there's a free like a free service that other people are charging for. So if we're paying you money, it's really meant as a show of goodwill. Right now we're paying $10 for an exclusive listing and $5 for an open listing, up to $25, and we'll give you either a Venmo or a Amazon gift card.
Back to the Venmo, huh? Back to the Venmo.
Yeah, Venmo's great. You don't like Venmo?
You were the one shitting on Venmo when we were talking about applying for rental, for your rental application.
Oh, yeah. Venmo is great for, like, person to person, but this is, like, something official. Like, this is something legit. You should – and also, you shouldn't have to be sending multiple Venmos. Like, the whole thing about what we're doing is it's one time. You upload your docs once, you pay once, and you apply endlessly.
So, okay. Let's say I'm a really dumb guy, and I was just like, oh, someone told me you got, like, you got a business that you're working on. And they overheard some of this. Would it be safe to say, like, it's kind of like Indeed for renting apartments, where you put your resume out there, but instead it's like information relevant for an application, and then that way you're able to just send it off quickly rather than doing a different one for each landlord, each different scenario, and oh, this guy actually wants this information from us, and this one guy wants something else. Like, was that good
I comparison? Actually hadn't thought of that before. I'd never thought about that before. That's kind of good. I like that. The one that I've been thinking about more, this is obviously going to sound grandiose, but it should sound grandiose. Like, any business that you want to be really big, you have to, like, come in with the attitude of being somewhat grandiose. Amazon allows you with one click to get any, like, item that you want, basically. Uber allows you with one click to get transportation. We want to simplify getting an apartment to one click. That's like the long-term vision that we're thinking about. So honestly, I've actually been thinking about Uber a lot, because I think there's a lot to draw from for our business. We're going to like a legacy space, right? New York apartments, very much still pen and paper business. Like, mm-hmm. It's still mm-hmm. very much face-to-face. Not a large part of the process has been digitized, which is kind of similar to the space that Uber went into. And Uber kind of did something similar to what we're trying to do. Their whole approach was, hey, cabbie, you're getting fucked over because you're having to either take a horrible loan out with a loan shark to get your token, or you're working for someone that has a token that's allowing you to drive with it, right? So, like, the cabbie was getting screwed over. We think that the agent in this case is getting screwed over, not by, like, their boss or a corporation, but by the listing service itself, which is really insidious, because the listing service essentially, like, took their stuff. And for a long time, StreetEasy was free. They just took their inventory and exposed it. And finally, once StreetEasy had become the dominant player in the space, where really no one could challenge them, they were like, all right, peace, boys, $7 if you want to get into our exclusive little club. And I think that sucks. Like, so what that's kind of how I'm thinking about it, I guess. Like, trying to break up a legacy business while helping all parties.
So in terms of other listing apps.
Yeah.
I'm asking because I'm at a point with my pursuit of being a stunt actor where I need to put my shit on those listing sites where it's like, okay, I need a headshot, I need a body shot, I need a demo reel.
Where do you post this stuff, by the way? Sorry.
I have my research elsewhere. I can tell you there's like stunt listing and stuff like that. Mm. Some of them are more acting focused. Some are just like extras. Some are like more stunt focused or fight choreography. But I can tell you so that you can review if you want to like review the websites. But something that's done on those is usually you upload like a whole suite of your things. Like, here's a demo reel for stunts. Here's a demo reel for like acting specifically. And here's photos that I want to use, and here's photos that I could potentially use for other things. But it's on the applicant or me to decide of those things what I want to be visible to where I'm applying. And it's not necessarily here's everything that's related to mm-hmm. that person. Is that something that you have to incorporate where you're like, oh, I don't want them to see everything if they don't need it? Is that something that you've already like developed into?
Yeah. So that's interesting, right? Like, and we've like played around with a lot of ideas about like what exactly should you expose. Like, one idea that we had was like, what if instead of the person looking for the apartment, you post your information and the apartment comes to them. Now that's a terrible idea for like a ton of reasons. Like one, this is like PII.
Yeah.
This is,
yeah, yeah.
All of this is very much like PII. So you don't want to, you really want to give the potential tenant as much protection, security, and control as possible, right? Mm-hmm. So we are building into our site a lot of like very clear messaging about like, this is what, who this is going to be shared with. Like, this is the agent, this is the landlord, which we can pull from records that he's going to be passing along your information to. So it's kind of like a different approach. As far as like what to pick out, that's an interesting thing. We don't really have to deal with that because the application is generally speaking so standardized. It's generally speaking 2 months bank statements, your credit score, and what else is in there? Your two bank statements, credit score, and some will ask for rental history, right? And something really cool that we are actually going to do is when you give us your two previous months bank statements, it's very easy for us to like review that and pull out which of those charges are your rental charges, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we can, without us ever actually having to look at your bank records, like we never actually see any of this stuff. This is what's cool about it. We are able to like pull out your bank records and be like, oh, this is how much this guy paid on his previous apartment. So if you go to your landlord and your landlord's like sketched out, he's going to know, hey, this guy's paid $3,400 a month for the last 12 months. Like he's good for it. You don't have to worry. So yeah, we definitely want to make both sides feel as secure as possible. Landlords, the thing that stresses them out the most is getting high quality tenants. They're constantly scared of being screwed over and they don't want to pay that charge to get them screened because it can be expensive. It's like $15 if you're not doing it, if you're not doing it in bulk, right? So we think that there should be a central place that does all of the credit pulls for applications. That way the cost goes way down. Because if you're doing all of the applications for every applicant in the city, the cost of the credit pull is going to like go down to like pennies, right? So we want to make it cheap, secure, and easy.
Okay, so you mentioned Uber and...
Yeah, I'm obsessed with Uber.
You mentioned Uber and you talked about how the application process is generally pretty uniform across the board. Instead of just pushing everything through the way it is but digitizing it, I think there's an aspect that didn't exist with taxis that does exist with Uber now that everyone is familiar with, and that's your Uber rating.
Oh yeah. Oh dude, come on. We're already cooking on that. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. We are introduced. The homes rating will absolutely
because
be a thing.
Dude, like it's gonna be. No one ever knows until it's too late that my landlord doesn't give a fuck about me, or this landlord fucking rules and I called him and he's here right away, or this tenant, she pays on time and it's great, but she's noisy and like that. I think that's gonna add a component to selecting who you're going to partner with a rental.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist today because you just have to kind of like, you just have to believe them. And now this is a little bit more like, democratized by like sharing it, you know, like to other users to say like, hey, this is.
So landlord ratings do exist. There is a company that does, landlord ratings and it's called Igloo. The problem with doing landlord ratings is that the landlord has way too much power in the relationship. The landlord doesn't give a fuck about their rating. Like they, and also they will fight you on that. They are like, they do not want Igloo to like become a thing because it's like bad for them. To grow the business and to get agents involved, you really can't do, I think it should exist, right? Like at a moral level, like landlord ratings should be available and transparent. The problem is to get there is a tough climb because they will just say, if this site is posting fucking shit about me, do not put my list, do not put my apartment building on there. And if you start, and they talk to, the landlords talk to each other. They are very much like they're pocket communities, right? Like they don't all know each other, but they know each other in pockets. Like the guys who own the buildings in the East Village, they know each other, right? And they do talk. There's definitely a certain amount of like price collusion and price fixing that goes on. I'm sure of it. So to give landlord ratings is to kind of like pick a fight with like a pretty big beast. So I don't necessarily think that's like something we're super interested in doing. We really want to focus on the relationship between the applicant and the agent right now. Like that is where we see like the big problem. Like the landlord side of the business is super interesting, right? Like the property management software that exists today is probably not very, I don't think it's that good. Like if you look at like AppFolio and a lot of the other companies, Yardi, I don't think that they're like, they're very much like what I would call boomer flow businesses. Like they functionally digitized the process, but they were flows that were made by like guys who are like from the last generation. And so like the UI and like the general like user experience is a lot lower than something like, I don't know, a perfect example of this I think is actually Ramp, where our friend Gabe Kaufman works. Like there is other credit card services, there have been for a long time. But like what Ramp and Brex are trying to do is like really, really modernize that and make those flows as efficient as possible and as user friendly as possible, so that you spend like less time actually having to use the thing and more time just accomplishing the goal and going back to whatever you want to do.
My question to you, Luca, is kind of back to what Miguel and I were originally asking. So you have this side hustle. I feel like it's almost disrespectful to call it a side hustle because it's just so well thought out. And like,
committed. You're very committed. Yeah.
And I understand the buy-in. And if anything, I'm all for it. And you have the company that you've worked for, where you've learned a lot. Like, how have you been, like, first off, what, like, beyond the mission statement of the company itself, what got you, Luca, into like deciding to work on something on the side and kind of like adding another layer on top of your responsibility? And also, like, how have you been using kind of like the change in workflow at your current company into your side hustle?
Okay, so I'll answer that first. We adopted a lot of what I started learning. So like the role that I actually serve in the company is I'm the CPO. So like it's very shared responsibilities. Like we are very much so it's four guys. It's my best friend from college.
Well, oh, what's a CPO?
A chief product officer. So my best friend is the CEO. I'm the CPO. And then the other two guys are serving as like our founding engineers. And we think that's like a good breakdown responsibility. Everything is like very much like a shared responsibility at this stage of a company. Like everyone has to be able to do everything. Everybody is selling, everybody is marketing, everybody is engineering, product design. You know, it's like it's a group effort. Like we're just sharing Figmas in the chat, like making mockups just out of code and stuff. Like it's very shared responsibilities. As far as like setting like our work style, that's probably where I've kind of taken on more of like the responsibility because I've had so much fun with what I'm learning at work. At work, we do 1 week sprints. Since this is a side gig and we're only really working nights right now, we work in like 2 week sprints right now. When we go full time, we will 100% be going to 1 week sprints. 1 week sprints are the way. I like very much think that it forces you to constantly be going. 2 week sprints offer too much time for like fall through. And it forces you to constantly be locked in and pushing yourself and each other. So I'm a big proponent of that. As far as like why I did this, I think I just really wanted to make something with my friend, like, and the two other guys who have become like my friends through this process, like who I've become like super, super close with. And then once we kind of had the real idea about the application, that was like a big moment for us. Like I can't remember who said it, genuinely. I think about this sometimes. But someone threw out the word rental passport, and everyone in the group was like, whoa, wait, that would be fucking crazy. And now it's just like, wouldn't it be fucking sick if you could make something that like genuinely like changed an industry or like had like a ton of people using it? Like, I think it would be cool to like make a lot of money. Like, that's fucking sick. I 100% want to make a lot of money from this. But the way cooler thing to me is like the impact. Like if you have like, if even, cause I, of course, like once we get traction with this, other people are going to imitate it. Like Zillow is going to adopt this, right? Like anyone who sees the directions that rentals are going, I think will see that this is a better business model for rentals. And even that would be incredible. Like just to have like to force like a paradigm shift in the way like business is done, that's fucking sick. I've become obsessed with, this is kind of cringy, I guess. I started watching Super Pumped, which is the show about Uber. And I'll preface this by saying I've only watched it up till the point before he kind of like goes off and does fuck shit. So I've only seen like the come up. So, like, I right now am obsessed with Travis Kalanick. I listen to, like, I've listened to a frightening amount of, like, his talks that he's given. And, like, something he always talks about is that he's way more focused on impact than anything else. And I think that's, like, the mindset to have if you want to build something really big, is to, like, not think about, like, necessarily how you're going to monetize it, but think about, like, how can you get this in as many people's hands as possible and make people, like, fall in love with it.
What's interesting about what you're saying is that, like, you know, we had another guest on, Jeremy, and I think me, Miguel, Jeremy, the three of us are kind of in the same boat where we've been maybe burned isn't exactly the right word, but kind of like
we're doing the side hustle because we are like
By corporate America. But it's it seems more like you, if anything, have had really good experiences and like learning experiences in your corporate job and now are actually just like passionate about this really good idea. And so you decide to add something to your plate instead of like running away from your main thing.
Well, I love coding. I genuinely love writing like front end code. Like that, that is like 100% true. There was a period where I fell out of love with it though. Like, and I knew you for a large chunk of that period, Nate. And it really wasn't, I think, until I had my knee surgery where I like fell back in love with it again and like got kind of hooked into like web dev YouTube and was just like, part of it was like, I was literally sitting at home and I just couldn't do shit. And I'd been playing Elden Ring for like five, six hours a day for like 2 weeks after my surgery. And Madison was like, Madison, who's my girlfriend, by the way, was like, maybe let's do something constructive with our time. And I was like, all right, let's like start like fucking around with like code again. And I found this guy named Theo Brown on YouTube. His channel is called Theo. He's an ex-Twitch.
Hey, no free promos. We're bleeping that out. No free promos.
His YouTube is Miguel-Mariano.
Anyway, he has a great like web dev focused YouTube channel. He's an ex Twitch guy. He started his own company, which I think you guys should check out. It's called ping.gg. It's literally, I think, the same exact kind of software as Riverside. Like, it's meant for creators who are doing live stream calls with multiple people. I don't know if this does live streaming as well, but it's essentially like a service for that, because he learned a lot about like live streaming, obviously, at Twitch. And he just does like videos, not many tutorials, but it's mostly like doing like little pseudocode things or even like building like little small things to show like new technology. Like, he does a lot of stuff with like, he obviously talks a lot about React and Next, and I'm a React and Next fanboy like for life.
Explain for listeners.
Oh yeah, so React is a front-end framework, and then Next, what would you call it, it's like a meta framework that's built on top of React that allows a lot of things that don't come packaged with React. When it first came out, Next was mostly focused around like server-side rendering. It still is to a large extent, but now they're doing a lot more with like server rendered components, i.e. like, quick explainer of what I mean by that. So typically JavaScript is sent to the client and it's run there. React server components is a slightly different model where the code actually is only ever running on the server. I actually don't fully understand how that works. I need to learn so much more about this, but it's kind of like a new way of doing things. So he does lots of videos on this. And I got like really into it and just started making like a lot of like, the first thing I really made that was like my like kind of entry into this was at my job. This was while I was injured. I overheard a woman at work complaining about applicants for our product having to email their W-2s to her and her losing a W-2 in her inbox. And I was like, that sucks. So easy to do that. Image, PDF upload, store it somewhere, build a client for them to upload it, build a client for them to review it. And I went home, Madison was gone, and I made it in like one night. I just went ham. And I used a lot of like things that you wouldn't necessarily use in production. Like, I used a lot of like smaller packages. I used, Theo has a thing called Upload Thing that is like a wrapper around S3 that allows you to do image uploads and PDF uploads directly from the client, which is really nice because you don't have to like set up a server. And I brought it into work and I was like, look at this thing I made. Like, we should do this. Like, we should do this. We should do this. And the company was going through this kind of turbulent transition where, like, they weren't sure of the future direction. And so we weren't necessarily being told what to do. We'd gone through a layoff. And so there was like a, there wasn't a ton of leadership I was getting. So I was like, let me make this. Just let me make this. Like, I just kept like asking people, showing it to more people. I went up, when we did our offsite, I literally went up to like every like head of department or like anyone senior. And I like forced them to watch me like use it. And eventually, after like hounding all these people, they were just like, okay, like you, this product guy, who's awesome, he's since left the company, and like one designer can go work on this. I worked on it for many months. It got shut down for like many reasons. A lot of like, kind of like, I don't want to complain, but like it got shut down for reasons that I felt like were kind of not, they just didn't want to go in that direction with the business. And I understood that, like, cause I started building on top of it and like adding like crazy stuff. I started just like taking other parts of the company software, like that lives in Salesforce, and just recreating it in my little app, just to like, be like, what if we did everything in my app and just like completely got rid of Salesforce and all these like expensive softwares that we buy. And obviously that's like a really tough sell to be like, let this like then 25-year-old kid like rewrite the entire company. And so like for probably just reasons, they were like, let's not do that. And they kind of shut that down. But that was like kind of actually, now that I think about it, the first,
that was your gateway drug
of like, oh, what if I like, that kind of got me into the idea of like a startup within a startup. Cause we actually ran that project like a startup within a startup. We did like user research with people inside the company and our like customers. Like, it was so fun to get to be like really included in like setting the product direction of like, what are we going to build and why? And then like trying and going and pitching it to the other people in the company, and failing quite often because they didn't want to change because they were used to using Salesforce, or they're used to using PandaDocs, or they're used to using DocuSign, or I wasn't really thinking about replacing those, but like ProDeal, which is like a document storage solution, or Dropbox, they didn't want to change. So it was hard. But that definitely, now that I think about it, got me being like, I want to have more of a impact on like what we build. And that's kind of why I like the dynamic we're in now at work, where like engineering is very much included in the product direction. Like, I work so, so closely with my product manager, Frederick, at work, where like we're constantly communicating about like what needs to come next, what we need to like work on. And now I have, so there's like a bunch of people that came over with the last acquisition that are like so smart and so talented. And I've probably learned more in the last 6 months than those guys came over about like being a software engineer than in like the entire year before that.
Damn.
I've definitely been rambling a little bit here, but yeah, I think now that I think about it, that was definitely like the first taste of like having more involvement in product and realizing that product is really fun, but really hard, really hard. The hardest job, actually. Yeah.
You also mentioned like the, how Uber kind of got its start and how there's more of like a, what's the word? A focus on reach.
Yeah.
That was kind of something I talked to Miguel about like the other day. There's this video I watched on YouTube. It was this fitness influencer me and him had both seen before. I'm sure you've seen, Luca, but he had like this video on YouTube. It was really catchy. It was like, the title was like, how I make money without any ads or without any sponsors. And basically he says he has like the Star Wars model, which is that the like Star Wars itself is essentially like, there's no barrier to entry. It's the cost of a movie ticket to watch Star Wars. But in terms of total sales, I think all 9 Star Wars films have only grossed, I think it's less than $1 billion or something like that. It's actually not even anything insane. But as a franchise or as an IP, they're worth like $7 billion. And that's because of all the extras.
Everything else.
The books, the toys, the merch. And even though that's not their main sell, their main sell is the movies. Their main moneymaker is everything on the side because they just have a dedicated fan base. And, you know, cue in the Patreon ad, which I'm going to cut in post. Guys, we want to shoot out our Patreon, our podcast pals.
Shout out. We want to shoot them out.
So we want to shout out to our Patreon and the patreon.com/DanielCho, our podcast pals. It's only $3.90 a month. With that, you get bonus segments. You get the episode early before it drops. We call it Mind our bloopers, because we show all our bloopers and all our outtakes and bonus segments. I think on this week we're going to talk about Twilight Imperium, which is the game me, Miguel, and our guest Luca are playing. So we want to shout out Alex Dow and Robin Huang. We somehow lost members from this month to last month, but we love you guys. No! Thanks for supporting us.
No. Yeah, thanks, Alex. Thanks, Robin. We'll see you on the Galactic Battlefield. And if you think of anything that you want from us, anything extra you want from us, don't be shy. Let us know, because we will do it.
Yes. Oh, and guys, leave comments and questions down below in the YouTube video, and we will try to answer them in the next episode. But, like, I was kind of, like, focused on, like, you know, my Patreon stuff for this podcast, or my own stuff, my YouTube videos. But I'm kind of realizing now what I should be doing is, like, focusing on, like, just giving free valuable content, like on Instagram, like on my Patreon. Initially I had like a lot of exclusive interviews, but I'm actually thinking about releasing those to the public, because I think that'll get just more eyes on me.
I think that
the internet cut out.
Am I back?
You should look up Eugene Teo.
Am I back or no?
Yeah
Okay. Dude, yeah, I think you should give everything away for free. Like, until you get really, really big. Like, there's always going to be time to monetize. Yeah. And, like, if you're not seeing that growth, if you're not seeing, like, month over month, like, increase, then maybe you need to think about, like, monetizing a little bit. And there's no reason not to have, like, a monetized option for your content. Like, there's no reason to put, like, at least some stuff behind a paywall. But as much of that stuff as you can give away, because, like, you're just going to bring more eyes to you. Like, dude, look at the Liver King. The Liver King, that guy didn't give a fuck about, like, monetizing at first. He just was trying to get as much as he could out there. And, like, it got revealed when he, like, got busted for taking steroids. Like, dude, that guy was calculated. That guy was like, I need to get as big as possible and, like, make money on all this other stuff.
Yeah, or look up, like, Eugene Teo or Athleen X or Jeff Nippard. So this is outside of the jiu-jitsu realm. This is more on, like, personal training, bodybuilding and just athletic training. A lot of times what they have are these like informational instructional videos on YouTube and Instagram, and it brings you in, but then you reach a point where you're like, okay, I'm adopting these things. I really like this guy's teaching style. Eugene Teo has an app for programming for strength or for hypertrophy. Jeff Nippard has like preset templates. Athleen X also has like preset templates, but a lot of their shit is free online, and that's their marketing to be like, kind of like what Luca's saying, is like not necessarily saturating the market, but like getting you to get in the first place. And then when someone like appreciates your teaching style, and I know that this is like personal training and not necessarily jiu-jitsu, but I don't see why that couldn't like apply in some degree. So
in jiu-jitsu, I feel like the thing that is different about jiu-jitsu is that the performance and actual competitive success aspect oftentimes plays a large part in the interest and ability to like monetize, right? Now there's people that break outside of that. Dima is one, and more people are starting to break out of that. Like historically, Nate, you'd agree with this, right? The only people that could sell shit were the athletes, right? Like those were the only ones who were selling shit.
Yeah. I mean, Danaher has been the first guy. Yeah.
John was the first one who broke through. But John was like...
And not only that, he's like the first guy to really make millions on selling just instructionals.
Dude, crazy. That guy has made so much money. Now more are coming. Like Dima is getting really big. I'm sure that there's others. I'm less in the scene than I was like a year ago.
And this isn't... Jiu-jitsu isn't unique in that... it primarily is the athletes that historically have had that. But if you think about bodybuilding, primarily it was like, if you're going to buy something, it's from someone who's like won something before, until more recently, where there's a lot of, I don't want to say influencers, but there are a lot of influencers that are making decent money, and they've never competed in their lives.
Is Sam Sulek would fall in that category? I don't think
I don't think he's formally competed in his life.
I think he's going to.
Yeah, Lean Beef Patty has never competed in like bodybuilding. I think she's recently competed in powerlifting, but like it's almost like a different path now, where it's not necessarily like, hey, I've proven that I'm the best in competition and you need to learn from me. It's actually more a, hey, I know how to teach or I can get a point across that connects with an audience. Because a lot of times the best athlete is not always the best teacher. And so this is kind of like that middle ground.
I agree with that. I think even a step further abstracted is like people who just love you and love your personality and want to support you. Because like, yeah, someone might be a great teacher and that's why you like them. But sometimes they're just like a funny dude, like Craig Jones. I know you don't know who that is, Miguel, but there's this guy named Craig Jones. He's putting out like BS instructionals that sell for $200 and it's like 30 minutes of content, but people love it just because they love his brand, they love his humor.
Yeah.
And I feel like creating a persona that is likable, you will just find people who want to support you because they support what you do.
Yeah, Sam, I think that comes to Sam Sulek is
Sam comes across so
genuine.
Authentic.
He's just genuine. And
I mean, besides the fact that he's on like a shit ton of horse tranquilizers, you know, and just juice to the gills.
Right, but the point remains the same, that just because the pool of like competition for, let's say, the influencer area space is wider now, a lot of people are copying other people. So if you're trying to find a way to have like your quirkiness and things like that come across, I think that's what is gonna like stick. Because for a while I was posting like random bullshit when I was like first starting to let people know that I was personal training, and people were messaging me that were like, hey, I think you're pretty good at like getting a point across, and so I'm interested in like working with you as a coach. And I'm not on gear, I'm not the most jacked guy in a room. If you like, and traditionally personal trainers are, people think personal trainer is sitting there with you watching you counting push-ups, and so none of that is what I was doing. It was just kind of like, oh yeah, Miguel got his point across, he's funny, I like him, and I can see myself like getting critiqued by him without feeling like judged, you know. So I think that's kind of like I don't know how this necessarily applies to Luca, but it's kind of like a transition that we were talking about how
I got you.
We were talking about your company. So
no, we were talking about the importance of reach. Like,
impact.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of like we think of that as like, I think every generation probably thinks of that as like a new thing, like a new concept for their era. But it's kind of like always been this way. Mm-hmm. Like the biggest stars and the biggest names in any industry are the people who are able to get themselves to like the most people. Like the Kardashians the Kardashians did this in the 2000s, and I'm sure different like influencers and big personalities. What's different now is you can truly come up on your own. I feel like that's what's kind of crazy about now. Is like you can just start in your room recording yourself. Like before, you needed like the backing, you needed like connections in Hollywood, like you needed something to prove your legitimacy. Now you can, if you are authentically yourself and you're authentically like giving value to people like you're doing, Miguel, like with your like routine, because you don't just do personal training, you also program, right? Like that's a big part of what you're doing.
Yeah,
see, I think that's kind of like the future. I feel like I'm honestly surprised that's got to be getting more and more popular, because I feel like that's really what people want. They want like good workouts that they don't have to plan out in their head. Like they don't have to be like, oh, I'm going to do this machine. Like I just get my card for the day and I do it, and I know it's going to work out for me.
Yeah, there's kind of like two approaches that I'm seeing right now. There's the more traditional personal trainer that's like, okay, I don't know what to do. I want someone to yell at me and tell me what to do. And people that need to hear that in person. But what you're seeing a lot more now is varying degrees of preset templates. So Jeff Nippard, for example, is one where he is like, I have my hypertrophy 3.0 and it's a set template, and you just choose whether it's 3, 4, or 5 days. There's also Mike Israetel, Dr. Mike Israetel, who's also he also competes in jiu-jitsu. He also competes in bodybuilding. But Mike Israetel actually, and Luca, this is kind of interesting. I think this is something I could see you digging into. Mike Israetel basically worked with someone to program an application that you set your goals, you set your target muscle groups, you set whether it's strength or hypertrophy. You set that in an app, and then as you do your exercises, it's almost like you rate like the difficulty level and then the follow-up soreness level. And that dictates how much progressive overload you should have. And it also sets like, it sets your deload week. It sets calories if you want to. And a lot of it is, this guy has his PhD in exercise science. So a lot of it is based on like modern research, but it's also built into an application. I haven't used it myself. It's something I've considered where I, if like my training gets stale. But I, that's like the digitization of that programming.
Have you heard of Playbook? Have you heard of Playbook?
No.
So play, I didn't know about this before. I like learned about this recently. Playbook is a, like a software company that allows personal trainers to make their own apps essentially like within it. It like, and then you build the workouts.
I think I've seen it. I think I've seen
there's another company that's getting into the space. There's another company from New York that's kind of getting into the space in a slightly different way called WAP. They do like, have you heard of WAP?
Yeah.
Oh, no way. I actually, I tangentially know their like founder. He knew people that I knew in college. But anyway, he's got a pretty funny Twitter actually. But anyway, they're kind of taking a different approach where they're not just doing it for the exercise industry. They're trying to do it for every specialized industry. So like, there's exercise ones, there's cooking ones,
marathon runners. And
yeah. And there's like, they're doing even gambling ones where like you essentially can create your own app where you sell your picks. Cause that's like a big part of their business is like selling gambling, pick services, like selling access to Discord channels where you buy picks, which is a crazy business.
Talking about maybe not completely moral business practices, I have a question. It's a spicy question for you, Luca, and it's based on your current business. Did you watch Bo Burnham's Inside special?
Loved it.
What did you think of his line when he said private property is inherently theft?
I just don't agree with that. I think that property is like, I think that ownership is something that should be aspired to. I think that I'm concerned by the decrease in the number of like homeowners. Like that's a bad
thing. Our generation.
I think now,
but home ownership. Okay, but what I think. You can tell my TikTok is very, what's the word? Marxist, but home ownership for oneself is different. But then a homeowner who accumulates their wealth on the backs of the proletariat and then sells back those homes to the proletariat might not be exactly the most moral thing.
I think that capitalism is good. Inherently, I think it is the best thing that we've. Here's a great line I heard that my friend always says: "Capitalism sucks, but it's the best thing we've come up with." And I kind of
Tucker Carlson quote.
I mean, it might be. My friend might have plagiarized that from Tucker Carlson. I didn't know it, but it's a good line, and I kind of agree with it, right? So, like, I'm very much a like fervent capitalist.
Only really works in an environment with infinite resources, right? Where there can be infinite growth. Where we are in late stage capitalist, where we're kind of
I haven't looked into all this shit. I think that you can probably talk like logical circles around anything I can say on this topic, which is like awesome. I think that like, I guess the best answer that I could give is that it's not something I think about really often, because I don't think I can have an impact on it. I don't think I can change the country from being a capitalist society to a socialist society. Like, I don't think that's something I can feasibly accomplish in my lifetime. I think I'm much better off playing within the boundaries of, I think it's much better for me to continue playing chess rather than flipping the chessboard, if that makes sense. No, I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with desiring to flip the chessboard. I just think that maybe it's, for me personally, I don't think I would feel fulfilled. Like, because, and maybe that's where I'm shallow. That's like, damn, we're getting deep here. Maybe I'm shallow and I can't live with the fact that I don't think I would accomplish anything if I tried to change the system. Or really, I think I'm far more likely, if I'm ever able to contribute anything that meaningfully means something to society, it's going to be from within the system.
I think from listening to you, you have like a desire to change like a subset of the system.
Yeah,
so exactly. you've seen what you can control, and you're like, practically speaking, I'm excited about potentially making an impact in changing this market or this industry. But and it's not necessarily like, hey, when it,
you can only change shit with money. Like that's the sad. That's kind of a, maybe a sad reality. Like if you look at any like super successful widespread like consumer behavior, whether it's fast food or it's like consumer technology, it's been accomplished by acquiring enough money that you can create a large reach. Like here's an interesting example. I was watching I watched an interview with the founder of what's it called? Is it Anthril, the weapons, the new kind of weapons defense Silicon Valley company that was founded by
the guy who did Oculus?
Yeah, and he's doing something really interesting. So at one level, you might say, hey, he's making weapons. That's bad. But what he kind of talked about in it was someone is going to make weapons. I think the weapons that are being made are shitty. They don't protect our soldiers. And they're over expensive and therefore hurting all American taxpayers. Because the old model is like the bidding system where you get paid for time, like the time to develop the product, the R&D, and then you get paid another cut on top of that. They're a products company. So they make a product and then they sell a certain amount to the government. So the government pays a lot less, and that means we pay a lot less. So in one sense, I'm like, I don't want war, which I don't. I think I would love if there were absolutely no war. But if I have to choose between getting like fleeced by fucking Boeing and Lockheed Martin or paying like a fair deal for fair work, I'd rather do that. Like, so it's interesting, but it's an interesting question, right? Like, I don't know. I haven't read nearly enough about like our economy and how it works to give any kind of like good or coherent answer.
Wait, Nate was just like, hey, so Luca, quick question for you. Is capitalism good or bad?
Yeah, but my vote is definitely that it's for the good. But not I'm not like into laissez-faire capitalism. Like I think the problem that my opinion on the problem that the U.S. system is suffering from is the presence of what I call like cronyism. So cronyism is my favorite example of cronyism is Amazon is like a big super successful company. If the U.S. government stopped giving out food stamps to Amazon employees, their workforce would be dead within like 6 to 8 months, right? The American taxpayer is holding up this business by paying for their unlivable wages. That's not real capitalism because that's not a fair fight. Another player can't get in the space and do that same thing, right? So the way that I think that you need your government to like support businesses. Like historically, that's always been the case. Like Japan's rise post World War II is because the government was like, we're going to pump money into electronics. We're going to pump money into cars. And it really helped. And the US does stuff like that and it's great. But when it gets to the point where like huge conglomerate businesses are getting these huge breaks, that's not great because it stifles competition. But it's like a fine line that you walk, right? Because then you look at something like, I'm going all over the place here, but like Figma, the acquisition of Figma got shut down. The Adobe acquiring Figma got shut down. That kind of is scary on a certain level because now basically the U.S. government is saying you can build a really big company, you can want to make something amazing that people want and other companies want to buy, and you want to exit. You want to take your chips and go home, and you can't do that. Like, that's also scary, right? So, like, it's this fine line that we have to walk, and I don't really know, like, what's going on in this country, but, like, my general sense is that it's, like, we're not walking that line super well right now, that we're not picking the right battles and not going after the right companies.
Okay, and with that, thank you, Luca. We are going to move on to our Bozo segment.
Okay, perfect.
Where we talk about
what is the
sandwiches.
Bozo segment?
No, it changes. It changes
every
day.
It changes every week.
Would it be possible about to quickly today. Run and go to the bathroom, like 2 seconds?
Yes, for sure. Go for it. Wait, okay, perfect.
Really quick,
so,
before we get into it. Oh, no, no, go ahead.
Sorry. Just go. What is it?
I was going to say, one like random thing maybe we can cover in the Bozo section, or maybe we just skip over this and I'll talk about it some other time. Dude, today was my last day at Unity.
Oh, shit, bro.
We talk about it now.
Did you say bye? I'm sad you didn't get your purple belt, dude. Like...
Okay, you want to talk about that?
Yeah.
So truth be told, I had a moment this week, and I talked to Jared about it because I was kind of mad at myself. I had a moment this week where I had that feeling where I was like, I'm mad that I don't have a purple belt, that I'm not getting my purple belt for Murillo.
You don't have something to show for your time here.
And then I was like, what am I fucking thinking? This is exactly what like Murillo has been trying to like, is trying to like teach all of us by having such a high standard and not just giving out belts because so-and-so's leaving or because so-and-so's been here for X number of years. And I was like, by doing that, he's trying to get people, what I think, to focus on just the process, to focus on the both the process and then also like the relationships that you build on the mats, to like say something super corny. But I caught myself being like, I'm mad about this, but it's like, no, like if the thing I've learned from being at Unity is it is really about the friends. Like it's about meeting Robin and meeting you. Like it's the friends we made along the way. But it fucking is like that is what it should be about. And he's trying to get that across by not making belts and stripes and accolades like the center of the culture. Right. He's trying to like get people to stop thinking about belts. That's at least what my perception is.
I agree on a macro scale, but you're giving the man too much credit. As somebody who knows the man pretty well and has talked with him a lot, you're giving him way too much credit, dude. He probably wasn't even thinking about it or wasn't paying attention, dude. It would have been nice if you had your purple belt to show saying you were a purple belt from Unity when you moved to SF. Feel like you were in Mike Tai's cohort. I don't know why. Maybe it's because of the way your injury lined up with it.
Probably had I not gotten injured, I'd probably be a purple belt by right now. But yeah. A lot of stuff would be different about my life had I not gotten injured.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. We wouldn't be talking on this podcast.
Yeah, I'm super thankful. It's super weird to say that I'm thankful for the injury, but yeah, I am.
With that, we're going to move on to the bonus segment. I was inspired because I was looking for a really good sandwich in Taiwan. The sandwich is here. It's always, the bread is super sweet for some reason, even if it's white bread. And they put like the thinnest slice of meat here. And I tried telling my brother-in-law, I want a good sandwich. He's like, sandwiches are so good here. I was talking about a Cuban. I want a Cuban. He's like, they're better than actually in Cuba. I was like, the fuck are you talking about, bro? There's honey in the Cubans here. Like, dude, no. So we're going to do a ranking of sandwiches. I'm going to list off 10 sandwiches, and I want you to give a ranking 1 through 10, and it's blind picking. So I'm going to list off a sandwich, and you have to just say, give it a ranking, and you can't repeat the ranking. Do you guys understand? So it's like, I'll say,
who's keeping track of the numbers? I will.
I'll keep Nathaniel and Post will, like, put a visual on screen, okay? There's 10 sandwiches. All right, here we go. Grilled cheese.
Ooh.
And you guys have to come to a consensus. The two of you have to come to a consensus of where to place it.
I lean to 5. I lean towards a 5. It's a middle tier.
I'm 3-4 because like...
One being the highest,
yeah.
I'm going to say 3-4 because it kind of goes whenever. Ooh. I can go with 5, but I don't know what the other sandwiches are going to be.
You're right.
But the thing was, the 3-4 is like, have you ever, you know, in New York when you spend like $14 on a grilled cheese and it's like... It's got like fucking truffle and shit.
Why don't we do 4? I think 4 is a good number. Now that I think about it, I don't think I can name 10 kinds of sandwiches. And the fact that I can name
you
like
definitely can. There's like 40 or 50. I had to pick 10.
Oh damn. Okay. All right. Four. Let's.
I'm gonna
four.
Go four.
Okay,
okay. I'm gonna go four.
Okay. 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 A BLT.
I'm gonna go 7.
Oh dude, right. Let's go. Let's go.
Okay. A tuna sandwich.
Damn, that might be the 5.
That is 5. I was gonna say 5.
Now here I'm gonna say something. We're not talking about a tuna melt because I have a very low view of a tuna melt.
Tuna melt's not on this list. Don't worry. Tuna melt's not on this list.
Okay, good. So
the
5.
Thing about I agree with 5. That doesn't have as much like range as the grilled cheese. Like you don't go somewhere and they're like, oh no, they got like. Like bougie tuna.
I agree with that. The thing that's interesting about the tuna sandwich is it can be there can be ones And there can be tens for a tuna.
There's some bodegas with with dope tuna sandwiches, but I think just the range is not that. Okay, I'm gonna say hot take. Chinese food is bomb, but the best Chinese food versus the worst Chinese food, like the range is kind of not. It's not like super dramatic.
I see what you're saying,
bro. When you come to Taiwan, I'm gonna show you. It gets real good.
Okay. But Luca knew what I meant by that.
I get what you meant.
Okay, banh mi.
That's top. That's a top three for me. We haven't cracked the top three yet, right?
Okay, let's put a good banh mi. I actually eat. I'm kind of being judgmental because I eat a shit ton. I go to Lucy's in Bushwick all the time.
Oh, you live so close to Lucy's, right?
Dude, it's like a block and a half away. I've been there probably like 100 times since I've lived here. Easy 100 times.
Yeah. I think the banh mi is like our DEI pick, you know? That way we have like a little diversity so that people don't think that we got...
There's more diversity on here.
Shout out Alex Dow.
We love Alex Dow.
We love the Vietnamese.
One of our top tier Patreon supporters also. Okay, next one. We got a Philly cheesesteak.
That's tough. Six?
We got seven picked already. I'm just thinking about other sandwiches. I can't really, I don't have a lot of sandwiches that come to mind. I'm like between 6 and 8.
Let's do eight. I'll occasionally have a Philly cheesesteak, but I don't go for it a lot.
I never order a Philly cheesesteak except for like if I'm in Philadelphia and I'm like, we gotta do it.
In a blue moon. I used to like them more when I was younger. When I was a kid, I really liked cheesesteak, but not so much anymore.
Okay. I mentioned this one earlier, a Cuban sandwich. The inspiration for the movie Chef, if you've seen it.
This could be crazy.
We don't have six yet. What are you going to say?
You're
going to say 10?
I'm not.
Wasn't the tuna salad 10?
No, the tuna salad was 5. Eight.
Oh, yeah, it's 5.
The tuna salad was 5.
What's 8?
Oh, right.
8 was the Philly cheesesteak.
Okay. I'm okay with 10. I'm okay with 10 for the Cubano. I'm actually okay with a 10 for the Cubano.
Yeah, I'm not a Cuban guy.
Wow. Because I live kitty corner from a Cuban restaurant or a Cuban. You've been there, Nate. It's like a mom and pop spot, and like the first bite, I'm like, okay, that satisfies what I was craving, but then everything after that, I kind of smell like it's like got that poor quality pork, and this is a good spot, and people like love the Cubanos there, and I'm just like,
I just don't. I would never get one. I would never like think to order one. They have mustard on them, right?
Yeah,
I don't like mustard.
Oh God, bro. Okay, this is a good one. I saved this one for
PBJ. PBJ's got to be on this list.
Oh, that's actually the one I was about to throw out. PB&J. I was saving it for a later pick. But yeah, PB&J.
What are you thinking, Miguel?
I feel like saying 2 is childish.
I have a comment to say once you rank.
Ages. I have not had a PB&J in.
That's why I said it sounds childish. I almost made one today.
When was the last time? Can you recall the last time you had a PB&J?
PB&J is my go. Really? PB&J is like if I'm hungry and I'm about to go train and I know I'm gonna be hungry mid training, I need something to eat. I'll make a PB&J.
We're in a tough spot though because we've used 3, 4, 5. What have we, Nate? What have we used?
No, I think we haven't done 6.
You haven't done 6. You haven't done 9, 10. Oh, sorry. You haven't done. Sorry, you haven't done 9. You haven't done 6. You haven't done 1 and 2.
1, 2.
Okay.
6.
If you don't do the most New York sandwich,
yeah, I know that's gonna be.
I'm gonna be pissed.
Okay, I want to say this: the ranking of where you put your PB&J has to do with how much love your mom gave your PB&Js when you were a kid, and the fact that it's only a 6 for you guys. It says
my
a
mom
lot.
Didn't. No, rice.
Says a lot.
We ate rice.
My mom's. Oh, okay, right. You're Filipino. Okay, that's true.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Also, so the weird thing about PB&Js growing up, I did not like jelly that much.
PB&J of the Philippines.
There's no PB&J of the Philippines. PB&J of the Philippines is rice, eggs, and spam. Together.
Okay, guys, we have the last three. Okay. Meatball sub.
9.
9. Yeah, I'm fine with that. Barely.
Okay.
Get.
The final 2.
The thing about the meatball sub is it's not. The shape doesn't make sense,
dude.
It
always falls apart. It never stays together.
The shape doesn't make sense. Like the fucking slit for the bread and then you put circles in it. It doesn't make any fucking sense.
Okay, now off of that, another Italian sandwich. Now, this is something that my dad made for me as a kid.
We gotta finish this, Luca. We gotta finish this. No, okay, no segue. Sorry. Okay, the no, final sorry. Two sandwiches.
Fuck them.
Bacon, egg, and cheese on a roll, salt, pep.
One.
What are our numbers? What are our numbers?
One and two.
We need one and two.
Two.
Oh, two. Oh. You say two, I say one.
I'm saving.
If you know the first one's gonna be Reuben, okay, I'm with you on that one. So if one is Reuben.
You can say Reuben's not on here.
No, I know what's going to be the next one.
Pastrami?
I don't think you do. Egg salad.
Where's the fucking chopped cheese, you bastard? How could you not put chopped cheese on that list?
Bacon, egg, and cheese, salt, pep. We had to choose one New York sandwich. Bacon, egg, and cheese, salt, pep is higher.
And you picked that over the
chopped
cheese? Yeah. Dude, you should.
Bacon, egg, and cheese sells more than chopped cheese. Chopped cheese is good.
Wait,
I love
dude,
it. It's an egg.
Chopped cheese is New York. Chopped cheese is
whatever. Man saw one YouTube video on the chopped cheese and thought he was like a New York native.
For 7 years.
No, we did
whatever,
not just,
bro, whatever.
We did not just let egg salad take number one.
Yeah, that was a draft.
Yeah, you guys did. You guys did.
We just fucked
that was
up.
Awesome.
Bacon, egg, and cheese is my one.
I like a bacon. I'd certainly put a bacon, egg, and cheese over fucking.
Well, it's too late, Luca, because I think you put bacon, egg, and cheese at two, so egg salad is one for Luca. And with that, guys, where can we find you? That was a great pod.
Luca first.
You can find me at Luca. Oh, God, my Twitter handle's so bad. It's Luca G. Guglielmi. It's like my full name. I really need to think about shortening that. Now that I actually try and like tell people to watch it, I tweet mostly about like technology and stuff occasionally, opinions. When I feel like it. Cool. But yeah, you can find me there. And go to our website at tryhomes.com. Homes spelled like Sherlock Holmes. Check us out.
Tryhomes.com.
If you're an agent, hit us up wherever. You'll find our email on the site. And we'll give you some money for your listings.
Nice.
Okay, Miguel, where can we find you?
At Miguel Mariano, M-I-G-L. M-A-R-I-A-N-O. I'm a personal trainer and also trying to be a stuntman right now or do motion capture for video games, and I kind of just pick up whatever hobby. So if you have anything interesting to present to me, message me. Also on YouTube, Miguel-Mariano. I have a lot of like exercise tutorials, short, concise, and I'm the one doing them. So if you want to see a fat ass...
Guys, Miguel's stuff is really great. I just had a back injury, and he sent me like his basic workout program, and it's like this Excel spreadsheet. It's very organized. Every workout has an associated video that he recorded on his YouTube. It's like super easy to use. I really recommend it. And you can find me, guys, at Anchovies on Instagram. It's like Anchovies just without the A. I'm Who's Nathaniel Cho on YouTube and TikTok. I stream every day on Twitch. Which is twitch.tv/anchovies. And you can find me and Miguel. We have our Patreon. Right now it's just patreon.com/NathanielCho. I'm thinking about changing the name so it's more associated with the two of us. But yeah, you can find us there. Thanks for watching. That's it, guys. That's the pod.
Luca, bye. Thanks for talking with us. Good luck on your move, and I'll see both of you on the Galactic battlefield.